Chinook. It's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage,
how things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profile, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Profiles, where we sometimes have the chance to talk to interesting people who come our way. In the studio today is Mary Jane Fate. Her name is familiar to readers of the Thunder Times and to Fairbanksans especially. She helped establish Alaska Land. She is vice president of the Fairbanks Native Association, and her name is known outside from her work on two major studies by the North American Indian Women's Association, and she has been national president of that organization. The list goes on. She is literally afraid to count the number of boards and committees she's on. In fact, I just forgot two important ones. She is president of the Institute of Alaska Native Arts and treasurer of her village corporation. And that last job, perhaps, is one she enjoys most. Mary Jane Fate grew up in the village of Rampart, that's on the Yukon River, northwest of Fairbanks. However, she's made a transition from village to boardroom and back with considerable style. And she is proud of growing up in the bush.
It was wonderful to me. It was a hard life. My parents and our family, there was four of us children. My dad was a trapper, so in the winter we trapped at His Creek, which is about 25 miles above Rampart. In the springtime, we muskrated at about 12 miles above, or sometimes as far upriver as Stevens Village, in the lake areas. And then in the summer, we went fishing, and that was located below Rampart. So we were really nomadic, as you would read about. It was hard work. I remember Mom and Dad loading the sled with all of us kids in one freight sled with supplies enough for all winter. There was no way you could get in and out. And then trapped through an area of maybe 100 miles. And it was around the His Creek area. We missed a lot of our grade school, a lot of our academic education. And I'm sorry to say we didn't have much room to take books or magazines. And so when our education preparation was really not geared up to what it should have been.
But you were learning something very valuable, even though it wasn't from books, weren't you?
Yes, well, we knew what we were doing, and we knew how to survive. We did make a living. We never went broke. I mean, it was a business. Selling furs, you had to know what you were doing. My folks didn't travel much out of the village, so we didn't meet very many people. We only saw maybe two or three sleds, teams would come by our trap line a winter, so that was our only link with the outside.
Was it lonesome?
No. Mm-hmm. We missed other kids, I know, but we never did dwell on it. We were always doing something else or just playing.
Now what about the work?
I didn't think of it as really as work, but we all had duties, as I recall, and Mom and Dad worked as a team. My mother worked as hard as my dad did, and they both went out, and many times we were left alone and had to take care of ourselves, and which could be child neglect today, maybe, but we had our duties, and we had to, it was just something you had to do.
What were some of the things that you did?
Well, we had to cook for one another and help with the wood, of course, and carrying water, melting snow, and feeding the dogs. Just miscellaneous things. I often wonder, why didn't they let us skin out the furs?
I was going to ask if you handled the furs.
No way. It was a very, very expertise job, I'd say, that Mom and Dad, we couldn't afford cutting a skin or messing it up and leaving too much flesh on the hide and stretching it out wrong. The timing, every minute, is important when you're in a situation as this, and there was no fooling around, and I think us kids would have fooled around.
And your mother still does make her living in with her work with fur and sewing and crafts, doesn't she?
Yes, she. When we came to Fairbanks, Mom had to find a job because my dad had passed away, and she had to support us, and so she started as house cleaning, and then she right away someone noticed that she had a little bit more on the ball than cleaning house. She was cleaning for a lady who owned a store, so they put her in as a sales clerk, and then doing her windows and so forth. But she also sews, and she does a lot of, you know, her arts and crafts, but mostly clothing beautifully, and sell them, and also in the summertime fish, and get all her foods prepared in the village.
And I understand that you do that, too. You spend some time at a fish camp.
Yeah, we do every summer. We've always done it, our whole family, and back to His Creek where we were raised. And it's hard work, and the kids enjoy it, really, because it's something, it's so natural. It's a lot of work, and you're together and no telephones. And it's good therapy.
Well, it's hard for me to visualize you at a, you know, working in a fish camp or, you know, out in the village, because here you are elegantly dressed. You've got samples of a very important work that you've done. How did you progress from the village to being kind of an important figure in Fairbanks?
I've always been involved, and maybe it's because I saw where there were needs many years ago in a village without an academic education, and then having to go to an all-Indian school, high school, which is located thousands of miles away from home. No telephones, and we weren't able to go home and visit our parents. So, and only that type of standard of education. And I can't really compare it with a non-Indian school or a public school or a private school because I didn't attend one. But I knew when I got to college that I was kind of an education cripple, really. I wasn't really prepared academically, and I did so want an education. So it was terribly hard when I came out here to the University of Alaska. I didn't know what a term paper was, and I was in English 101, and many of our own people dropped out, and I could see why, because you really feel you're taking too much time of the instructor's time. You're not prepared like the other students. It's hard to compete. So seeing all of this, I really stress in the villages, right at home, before the children are in school, let there be reading material in the home. And I know the parents have other duties for the kids, carrying wood, getting the water in, helping the smaller children, helping the older people. I remember we had to run and help cook for the senior citizens. And there's a lot of duties, and when our people see the children reading, sometimes that might be an idea that they're wasting their time, they're being lazy, just laying there. Even if it isn't super classic material, just sloppy books, funny papers, or comic books, encourage the kids to read, and that's even before school.
Are you worried, though, about having so much outside influence in the villages might take away some of that feeling of family responsibility that you grew up with and it seems important in your life?
Paula, I'll tell you what. I've seen the family unity very strong, and then all of a sudden, when all of us were taken from school at home, and I shouldn't say taken, because our parents really more or less pushed us out and said, get an education. I remember Dad saying, get educated and don't come back until you get educated, because there's not going to be the furs, you're not going to be able to fish to make money, you're not going to be able to really have a family and live off of the land like we have now. So we left. And the main thing, years ago, food was our survival, and I knew that because I lived it. But Dad said, education now is your, like your food, and go get it. So we left and we, let's face it, the family unity broke. There was no goals for the parents. They didn't have children in their homes. Some parents did not see their children for 8 years, starting at the age of 13, 12 or 13, through high, junior high, through high school, and then military for 4 years. And when they got back home, for instance, one father asked my husband and asked me, we took him to the airport to meet his son. He hadn't seen him for 8 years. What'll I say to him? How will I talk to him? I'm scared. And tears was in his eyes, and they were complete strangers. So the family unity, and maybe this is all over the United States, as I travel, I could see it. There is no real model of what a father should do, an Indian father, and what is a good Indian mother in a village. Years ago, it was the best trapper, the best snowshoer, mm-hmm. the best dog musher, the best fisherman, and my dad was, and I'm so proud of it. And that's something to be proud of, but now it's a different pace, a different age.
There's certainly no dwelling on the past for Mary Jane Fate. She is involved with shaping the future of her community and improving the status of Native people on a national and even international scale. For Chinook Profiles, I'm Paula Schiller, and Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaska Natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
This is Chinook Echoes. In a previous program, we heard Dr. Michael Krause talk about the Alaska Native Language Center. He described some of the center's responsibilities and purposes, the chief of which is to preserve and keep alive Native languages. In this program, Professor Krause explains why there are so few speakers of Native languages left. The history of the decline begins, of course, with the white people. First, there were the Russians.
Through the Russian period, the first 40 years was contact mainly with the Aleuts in the Aleutian chain, and it was one of hideous massacre and Holocaust. It wiped out 90% of the Aleuts, and that period ended in about 1785 when the Russians settled down in Kodiak, began, took on some government control, and also moved further toward the east, and moved into the Alaska Gulf. The second period, from 1785 to 1825, they enslaved the Aleut and Yupik populations that they met, but by spreading them around the whole Pacific Rim from California to Japan, making them do their sea otter hunting for them. But they didn't. The massacres ceased, at least, and the populations were not being decimated any longer. Mm-hmm. And the beginnings of Russian, better sides of Russian culture, like religion and literacy and so on, schools began. During the third period, 1825, say, till 1865, the last, the third 40-year period, I would say that the cultural history for Alaska Natives was downright good. It was a period of actual progress and flourishing, of educational programs in Native languages, literacy programs, literacy in Aleut, for instance, and the beginnings of literacy also in the Pacific Gulf, Yupik, and in in Tlingit even a little, and in the Central Yupik a little. When Alaska was transferred in 1867 to the Americans, there was practically no American influence for at least 20 years. There was an exploration, military reconnaissance, some continuation of the fur trade, but basically neglect of Seward's icebox for about 20 years. And in the 1880s only, Americans began to realize the potential value of Alaska and sent up prospecting began, mining began, the gold rushes were on the verge, and the missionaries arrived, and they began school programs. These educational systems under Sheldon Jackson, who managed successfully to mix state and church by getting federal support for missionary schools from the period 1890 to 1910, or 1905 or something, established the Alaskan educational system. And his purpose, or rather his language policy, was totally anti-native. He believed that no native languages should be permitted in the schools. From about 1910 to 1970, insofar as children came to school speaking native languages, they were punished for speaking them, forbidden to speak them. There were all kinds of physical and spiritual punishments inflicted on these children for daring to speak the language that they were taught by their parents. This did succeed in breaking the ancient heritage. The parents were no longer speaking, by 1970, were no longer speaking native to their children in the majority of the communities in Alaska.
Yeah, what languages is it too late for?
Well, again, I won't play God in any of this, but I can give you the facts as they are today.
Yeah, please do.
And let you figure it from there, that there is nobody under 20 anywhere in Southeastern who can speak any Southeastern language, Tsimshian, Haida, Tlingit, or Eyak. All the languages of Southeastern are spoken only by adults and not by any children now. Aleut, or Aleut Eskimo language of the Gulf, Pacific Gulf, is spoken by small children only in one village, namely English Bay. The Aleut language of the Aleutian chain is spoken by the children only in the small village of Atka. Everywhere else, small children no longer speak that. So there are two small sparks of life in the two so-called Aleut languages of Alaska, and none for the children in any of the southeastern Indian languages. For central Yupik, especially in the Kuskokwim heartland of that area, the children mostly speak the language, and there's a very strong possibility that the language will survive forever. Bilingual programs have gone well there, and the literature is developing, and the language is gathering strength in that central heartland. Although the children in the Bristol Bay areas and Yukon areas are speaking the language less and less, if at all. St. Lawrence Island is Siberian Yupik, the same as the Yupik Eskimo of Siberia in the USSR across the way. There, all the children speak the language, the population is increasing, and there's a bilingual education program beginning, and the literature developing. And it looks like that Eskimo language may survive for the rest of our history. On the North Slope, or the northern part of Alaska, the Inupiaq Eskimo language is spoken by small children nowhere on the Seward Peninsula or Norton Sound areas. Even King Island, which has been evacuated, no longer do their people in Nome speak, their children in Nome speak a language. No longer do the children of Diomede even speak a language, so I understand. The only children who speak this language are in the Upper Kobuk, in the villages of Shungnak, Ambler, and Kobuk, and on the North Slope, especially in Wainwright, some, but a minority now, of the children in Barrow, Anaktuvuk Pass, and maybe Nuiqsut, where there are children speaking that language. So the future of Inupiaq, the second largest native language in Alaska, is very severely threatened. So much for the condition of the Eskimo languages and the southeastern Indian languages. The interior Athabascan languages, as we define them, and as you can see on the map, are 11 different languages. I'll name them: Ingalik, no children speaking the language; Holuk at Anvik and Shagalak; Holukachuk at Grayling, no children speaking the language; Tanina, the Kukinlet Athabascan language, no children speaking the language except at Lime Village, population 45, and not no longer even all of those children. Copper River, language of Atna, no children speaking the language. Some of the children at Northway and Tetlin speak Upper Tanana, but the minority by now. Some of the children at Tana Cross speak the Tana Cross language, but a minority, I would think. None of the children in the Tanana region, that is to say, from the Good Pasture and Salcha Rivers in China and at Minto and Inanna, none of the children speak the native Athabascan of the our central area here. In the Cayucan language area, on the middle Yukon from Tanana down to Caltag and up to Koyukuk, there are no children speaking the language, even though that's the largest native Athabascan group inside of Alaska. The Han language at Eagle, nobody under about 20 can speak that, so I understand. And the two languages which, where there are children, a significant proportion of children still speaking the languages, are Upper Kuskokwim Athabascan at Nikolai and Tulida in the interior, but increasingly speaking English now, so I understand. And in the Gwich'in Athabascan language area, centering on Fort Yukon, but especially at Venati and Arctic Villages, Arctic Village, there are children speaking Athabascan fluently. Those two villages, Venati and Arctic Village, are the only two where children are still speaking, are still dominant in Athabascan. But I understand also that the very youngest are now becoming dominant in English even in those places. So the Athabascan languages of Alaska, except for a few small sparks of life that, who knows what could be fanned into some kind of a living flame with a future. They're either, unless some very radical changes take place, are going to be extinct within another century.
We'll discuss what those changes might be with Professor Krauss in our next program, Chinook Patterns. For Chinook Echoes, I'm Paula Schiller. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.